out here. Thank you.
Thank you. The third case this morning is James Bruce versus Holland Residential LLC.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please.
2 minutes. All right, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Grant German, attorney for appellant. May it please the court. The issue here is, did the trial court err when it, on summary judgment, dismissed all the claims of Mr. Bruce? The short answer is yes. There were multiple fact issues such that summary judgment was inappropriate in this case.
What were they?
The factual issues?
Yes.
The primary one is whether or not there was ice. Can I address that in my body? Because there's actually a lot, and it's taken in different contexts, and I will
okay.
explain.
All right.
I think
that is the crux.
I think it'd be clearer if I could kind of present it in the way that the court should have analyzed the facts.
Okay.
So the status, I mean, a lot of this is duty. The status of the plaintiff determines duty. In this case, he was an invitee.
There's no dispute about that.
No dispute about that. So the landowner has a duty to maintain the common areas free of hazards. This includes snow and ice removal. Now, the existence of a duty is normally a question of law. However, when the underlying facts that could establish the duty are disputed, this creates factual questions for a jury to decide. That's a mixed question of law and fact.
What case are you relying on for that proposition?
I believe that is a FOA.
Okay.
A FOA versus okay. Seattle. So normally a landlord is only liable for conditions of which it is aware. There are two ways the landlord can be on notice of a condition, actual notice, or constructive notice. This case involves constructive notice, and normally the plaintiff must prove that the unsafe condition existed for such time as would have afforded a landowner sufficient opportunity to identify the dangerous condition and remove the danger, in this case, of the common areas. Now, this is normally a question of fact for the jury. Did the, in this case, icy conditions exist long enough such that a reasonable landowner would have discovered it in the exercise of reasonable care? So getting to, so that itself is one of the factual issues, Your Honor, and also ice or no ice.
Well, it's only a factual issue if you presented evidence. So now you're getting to your expert.
Yes. My expert, a meteorologist, testified that the parking lot was ice covered with clear black ice for at least 2 days prior. I also presented evidence from a snow and ice removal expert talking about, this was in conjunction with the meteorologist, that when you have 100% humidity, which is fog along with freezing conditions, explaining that this creates a clear black ice. In contrast, the defense expert opined that there was no black ice. The defense expert believed that any ice was microscopic, what he described as white rime, R-I-M-E, that formed perhaps just minutes before the plaintiff was injured. So this contrasting evidence of my two experts plus an eyewitness at the scene who described that when she went to help the plaintiff, the area was coated with black ice that was difficult to see. That's in stark contrast to what their expert said. So this creates a factual dispute for the finder of fact, not for the judge to simply not consider our evidence. So interestingly, the trial court found that there was no duty because the condition at bar, the trial court said, was observable and obvious, and based that finding on Jules versus City of Bellingham. But the trial court's reliance on Jules was misplaced. Jules is a recreational use statute, and that was interpretation of a specific statutory immunity that is an objective test versus the subjective test that's ordinarily applied in common law negligence and assumption of risks issues. So in this case, natural conditions are generally not open and apparent dangers as a matter of law. And the evidence from the plaintiff himself was that he was not aware of the ice until prior to him falling on the ice. Interestingly, even if the obvious exception applied, for some reason the trial court didn't consider whether the Restatement 343 exception to the obvious condition would apply. Because under that exception, if the landowner would expect that a plaintiff would or invitee would proceed to encounter even a known or obvious risk, then that landowner does have a duty to keep the common areas safe, even from obvious dangers. So here's another question for the jury, a fact. Would a reasonable person in the plaintiff's position under this case think that the advantages of encountering the danger outweighed the apparent risk? And this was analyzed in Maynard versus Sisters of Providence, saying, did the plaintiff in that case, was he negligent in getting out and trying to help another driver, knowing that it was icy conditions? So there was a lot. The defendant's briefing to both this court and the trial court relied heavily on two cases. They're both Division III. Jesse versus City of Dayton and Havalbal versus Wolf. Now, there is a new case that has come out since the briefing by the parties on this case, so I didn't have a chance to include it in my materials. But Division II in Gleason versus Cohen, 192 Washington Appellate 788, 2016, says that Division III in both Havalbal and Jesse was wrong, that those cases were wrongly decided. And Gleason explains that there are implied primary assumption of risk and then implied unreasonable assumption of risk. Implied primary eliminates the duty, which is what the trial court found, but that's only properly applied in things like, for example, playing football is a classic example. There's an inherent risk to the sport. But
So Jesse, the two cases out of Division III, that relates to the assumption of risk argument.
Correct.
So now you've slid into that. Because one of the arguments is, as a matter of law, we should hold that Mr. Bruce assumed the risk.
Correct, he assumed the risk. Well, actually, that eliminated the duty is what they're arguing, but that's wrong. Because assumption of risk, if he assumed the risk under implied unreasonable, then that is a jury for the that is a question of comparative fault. It doesn't eliminate the duty. I try to explain this to the trial court judge. That's a comparative fault issue, not elimination of the duty.
Thank you.
You'll have 2 minutes. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, Ramona Hunter on behalf of the defendants. As an initial matter, the trial court committed no error when it found, as a matter of law, that the defendants owed no duty to the plaintiff and properly applied the case Laguna versus State, which remains good law. Laguna is the only case at play in either these proceedings or the underlying trial court proceedings that actually deals with what the fact pattern was here.
Now, Laguna is a case that is a state highway case.
Right, but it dealt with the idea of whether or not the state had a duty to respond in the face of a prediction of a weather system that even in that case they say had a virtually 100% chance of causing actual problems on the ground.
So state highway cases, we are familiar with Keller, we're familiar with the statute. There is a duty that the state owes to the traveling public. We understand that. Laguna is a case that is in that context.
Correct.
So what case law applies the state highway duty analysis to the duty that's owed by a landlord to an invitee.
There is not a case that stands for that. What I would point to is the absolute absence of any case under Washington law that says, and I'm not going to make a distinction here between a commercial and a residential landlord because this is a parking lot, so it's going to apply to either one as a practical matter. There are no cases that hold, particularly in Western Washington, that a landowner has an affirmative duty based upon a mere weather prediction to take affirmative action and apply de-icer. And part of the problem this case presents is if you take every single inference in the favor of the plaintiff, the only way to have protected Mr. Bruce from the obscure weather condition that is being claimed by the plaintiff would have been for this property owner to coat every conceivable surface at this large complex where any person might conceivably walk in de-icer based upon the mere prediction of possible freezing fog. You know, this case involves what plaintiff is trying to do, and I think probably the best question I got by the trial court is, how do you distinguish Sisters of Providence? And my response was, that was an actual snow and ice case that involves snow and ice. We don't have that here. What we have is an obscure scientific argument about freezing fog, a condition that plaintiff's own expert says is not a matter of common knowledge, wouldn't have been something that Rich Marriott and Steve Poole were telling people about unless there were tons of accidents. It is an obscure concept that potentially can form ice particles that are actually rime, which are more akin to frost than they are to clear black ice. When you have fog conditions temperatures.
But the plaintiff was not taking the position there was rime. That was your expert.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I understand that the case law on summary judgment sometimes from the federal courts is a little more clear on the idea than our state court cases, and I don't have one to cite you to. Mm-hmm. But essentially, a plaintiff just standing up and saying the sky is green, which is essentially what's occurring here, trying to deny a scientific fact that is objectively verifiable,
so
does not create an issue of fact.
So your position is that your expert testimony that you presented is objectively verifiable, and what the plaintiff presented was not, and therefore that does not create a material issue of fact.
Correct. So the issue is twofold there. Their expert had never heard of the term rime. I put evidence in the form not only of my own expert's declaration explaining, who's a PhD,
aren't you arguing that the expert isn't believable? I mean, that's a jury issue, isn't it?
No, I actually submitted documentation from Renton Airport showing that there was rime-producing freezing fog. His expert didn't even know what rime was. And that wasn't actually the basis.
Did you move to strike the witnesses' declarations?
I did not. I believe I did attack that and say that and raise that issue at the trial court.
The court denied that motion, I take it.
The court left everything in. Okay. But did recognize that there was objective evidence that Renton Airport is saying rime, that the fact that his expert didn't know that term, if it's being used by the airport, a source that both experts are pointing to for weather data, that rime was not something I had invented or that my expert had invented. But that wasn't the basis of the trial court's ruling. Ultimately, plaintiff saw his fall was unwitnessed. He saw no ice. We had no reports of anybody else seeing ice. And despite what counsel's arguing now, the record was that the plaintiff fell, it was unwitnessed, and he made his way back to his girlfriend's apartment. She didn't come out and inspect the area where he fell at the time he fell. If you take everything their expert says is true, freezing fog is unpredictable. It may or may not deposit something on the ground in an area where it occurs. If it deposits something, it might be microscopic and incapable of being viewed with the human eye. Where it forms, how much it forms, is 100% unpredictable. So if there was something on the ground, which plaintiff didn't establish how long it had been on the ground, or how my clients could have discovered and cured it before 5:15 a.m. on a Monday morning. On this record, the court found no duty to preemptively apply de-icer, which is consistent with the case law. And
when you say it's consistent with the case law, that's Laguna.
Well, I would say it's consistent with Laguna. It's also consistent with the fact that there is no case in the history of premises liability case law, which our state has a pretty rich body of, that says when there's a mere prediction of snow, a landowner has an obligation to go out and preemptively apply de-icer. We don't do that. And part of why we don't do that in the Northwest is we recognize that about half the time they tell us it's going to snow, it doesn't. There is no case that holds that there is a duty to preemptively de-ice. What the case law all says, and how I distinguish Sisters of Providence in any other snow and ice removal case, is it says when it's there and you know it's there, you have to deal with it. Well, here, they're talking about an obscure weather phenomenon. They didn't prove my people knew about or understood. Their own expert said Steve Poole and the other meteorologists wouldn't have been reporting about it, so how are they supposed to discover it? And how were they supposed to, if it moved in overnight, get out there, find it in the dark at 5-something in the morning and cure it before he decides to run around in the dark at 5:15, go into a racquetball game, and admits he was using no extra or due care? And switching to the assumption of the risk, the basis for the assumption of the risk argument here was he made it out to his car without incident. This is not akin to Sisters of Providence, where he observes that there's ice on the ground, that there is he's trying to get to his car but having a hard time. He makes it entirely across the property to his vehicle and is 100% safe and in his vehicle. He looks around and he decides that, you know, he doesn't like the weather conditions and doesn't really want his girlfriend out in the weather conditions. So he decides to not call from his car, not drive around, but walk back over the property, and he falls going back to warn her about the weather. And that fact pattern happens to fit the Hubble case. I mean, it is the fact pattern of Hubble, except with the only difference being in Hubble, it was accumulated snow and ice that had been there for some time. But in that case, plaintiff was, instead of staying in his apartment and calling and complaining about it, decides to walk to the manager's office and falls walking to the manager's office. And the court says, kind of like Jesse, once you decide you know about it, you know it's there, you understand that it creates risk, when you decide to engage in it and take the risk of slipping to go complain, then that is pure assumption of the risk. Now, the court didn't go here in that case. The court also didn't apply the recreational land use statute. The court just recognized that this was something that, you know, that the plaintiff was capable of detecting and should have been able to see, and that this wasn't a latent defect.
Well, didn't the court cite to the Jewell case?
No. I cited the Jewell case, and the court referred to it for the concept of, if you accept everything they say is true, freezing fog forms rime and it's white.
Mm-hmm.
And the Supreme Court in Jules says, it has a lengthy discussion of, if it's something you can see and it's observable, then according to the Supreme Court, it's not latent. So one of the examples
and it
was...
Does it make any difference that Jules is a recreational use statute?
I don't think so. I think the idea of what is a latent property defect, and mind you, their architect made it clear, unless there was accumulated ice, and again, there had been no precipitation for 10 days. I mean, we're talking about something obscure. We do not have any water here to have a lake effect or coat anything in inches of ice like Sisters of Providence. That's not this case. There had been no snow and ice, no precipitation for 10 days.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You have 2 minutes.
Thank you. Counsel's argument illustrates perfectly why my response brief is only a few pages long, because we are just missing each other. She's not addressing what my experts put in as factual evidence. If I'll ask that you look at the record and see with the multiple declarations that explain the basis for the opinion on how the black ice forms. It's not an obscure weather pattern. That with 100% humidity and freezing temperatures, which my meteorologist said were extant at that point based upon his observations.
Just at that point?
No,
or
over the whole weekend is the testimony. And that this will cause this black ice. It's not an obscure weather phenomenon. It's not rime. And I
so I can't. Was the testimony that the black ice was in existence for some 48 hours?
Correct.
Or? And no time.
Right. And my premises liability expert said you can't simply send your maintenance people home. They were there. We have the billing record, their records. They were there. They could have applied the de-icer, and it was negligence to go home and not de-ice it. So it's not about predicted. This is a real red herring. It's not about predicted conditions. Our case theory is about actual existing conditions, and we put evidence before the trial judge to show it. And so the court did reference Jules, and that briefly on the coat every conceivable argument, that also area is a red herring, and here's why.
And this is Sisters of Providence. But go ahead.
Right, sorry. Here's why. The apartment people knew that they had limited parking and that people used this particular grassy slope to come down to access the apartments. They were aware of it. They did not put any sort of designated walkway. They would only need to coat the area that was commonly used by the tenants with de-icer. That would have prevented it.